We're going to take a cue off of Jocko. The inspiring true story of Corey ten Boom, a Dutch watchmaker whose heroic efforts saved the lives of hundreds of Jews during World War II at tremendous cost to herself and her family. We're going to be talking about the watchmaker's daughter today. And I'm Emma Darren. Larry is a New York Times bestselling author and a whole ton of other awesome books in his repertoire. Larry, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are y'all?
This is fun. This doing is great. Fantastic. I love
good job.
Yeah.
Good job with the intro.
Thanks. We love talking nonfiction books. We do love our thrillers. And man, we've talked to a ton of awesome thriller authors.
My genre, what I essentially created, is nonfiction thrillers. So all my press stuff that goes out, the press release, everything says nonfiction thriller author. And that's what usually comes in the reviews. The reviews for all the books always say reads more like a thriller, which is what I wanted because I like thrillers and it's more fun to read that way.
And, you know, that's one of the things I'm really going to enjoy reading this is because I love reading thriller books, but I always like to get something out of books.
Right.
So if you're reading a really good fiction thriller and you have an author that knows what he's talking about, he gets the tech specs in there and you can look at things a different way. But when you're now talking about nonfiction thriller, it's like I love real life thrillers. Yep. So I'm really excited about this. And The Watchmaker's Daughter, and I love history books, but I love learning history through a different lens, especially like when you have a really strong protagonist. Mm-hmm. This is really cool, Larry. You've kind of jumped into a niche. You know, strong characters in a fiction and a nonfiction thriller genre. How do you come up with this type of, how do you find a story that's going to be able to captivate a reader?
Yeah, good for question. So long? It's difficult, because when I started out, I started researching Into the Lion's Mouth back in like 2012. And I obviously everybody knows what a biography is and everybody knows what a thriller is, but I really wanted to write a nonfiction thriller. And the problem or the hurdle that I always have is if you're going to write about a real person in history, they can't just do one or two cool, fun, or dangerous things. There has to be a whole menu of them because you have to write a whole book. So you have chapter after chapter after chapter, and good thrillers have cliffhangers, you know, every other chapter, and then mystery and misdirection and all the things that are involved in the nuances of just writing in that genre. So the difficulty for me is always to find an agent, to find someone that didn't, you know, wasn't a one-trick pony, did one thing. They have to have a lot of stuff that they've done. And so for every book, this is my fourth one now, Watchmaker's Daughter's number four. For all of them that I've done, I've discarded probably five potential subjects for every one that I've done. Because they don't pan out. There's not enough stuff. Yeah, they did one cool thing, one brilliant thing, one dangerous thing, and that was it. So that's my hurdle is to find somebody where there's just stuff going on all the time, and they did a lot of crazy stuff.
Is that why you selected World War II and for your time frame? Because that seems to be the theme also.
Well, I've always been interested in World War II because it's like the only event in history that was truly worldwide. I mean, the whole world, virtually every country was involved. So that makes it exciting. I was a political science major in college, so I studied, you know, history. But I've just been fascinated by World War II. And it's so much drama and stories between Hitler and Himmler and Goering and Churchill and Roosevelt and all the great players, you know, Patton and Rommel and Montgomery. I mean, what other time in history do you have all these exciting players? And so what I'm bringing to the table are people that you don't know about that did a lot of cool, crazy, exciting things. So,
you know, I talked to one of my buddies who's a thriller author, and he was like, you know, you have to have seven or eight different conflicts within the book. And it's true, like when you're looking at a nonfiction book, once in a while you get one or two, but to keep that story flowing,
yeah,
that's a pretty cool
Yeah, in fact, the I think it was Kirkus Reviews back when I wrote Codename Lease. They put in, the reviewer at Kirkus put in there, every chapter ends in a cliffhanger for the whole book. And I was fortunate because a lot of stuff happened between her and her partner there, Peter Churchill. There was just something going on all the time where one of them almost died or was almost captured. They had a German secret agent chasing them around France. So anyway, that's what I look for when I'm looking for stories.
That's an excellent point. You never really think of it from that perspective. We know World War II was life-changing for so many, and it still is. But when you put it like that, you never really think about how grand of a story it really was. And now to take little facets of that is really, really interesting. Have you considered going into any other time frames, or are you going to stick with World War II for a while?
No, my agent told me to stay in my lane. So I had hinted at it once, and he said, absolutely not. You have to stay in your lane. You're in World War II forever, which is fine with me because I like it. So that's my genre forever.
When I picture World War II and protagonists and everything, I always think of Indiana Jones, like the plane's going from here to there to everywhere else. And it's just, there's so much. I love history, and between the 20s and the 50s, there's so much in there. And that's because you got to remember the protagonists, that a lot of them were born in that the whole spectrum of time frame, mm-hmm. and to get them. And then all of a sudden the whole world is at war, the whole entire world.
Yeah.
There's such characters there.
And, you know, I mentioned some of the exciting people like Churchill and Rommel and Montgomery and so forth in which book was it? Winston Churchill, this was in the lion's mouth. Winston Churchill has to go to an intelligence meeting. This is April, right before D-Day. And he reads, and I had to order these. It's difficult. You can get archives from different places, but if you want Ian Fleming's archives, which is what I was at, I mean, I wanted all MI5, all MI6, but in particular, I wanted Ian Fleming's. They're kept in a safe. They're not in the main place. They're kept locked up in a safe. You have to buy all of them, and they come in sheets like this big. And anyway, one of them that I got, I'm reading, and it's Ian Fleming's reports back to his boss Godfrey right before D-Day. But anyway, in this stack of all these archives, I've got a memo that is a intelligence briefing, and an MI5 intelligence, because MI5 handled all the double agents, and this is what Winston Churchill read, and this was his April. It was produced in April, so he's reading it in May, I guess. Right before D-Day, and the whole thing is about my guy, Tricycle. It doesn't say his real name. That's his code name, Tricycle. And it goes through how he's convinced the Germans that, you know, we're attacking later. It's not going to be at Normandy. It's going to be at Calais. He's convinced them it's going to be in June. And, oh, by the way, he swindled $80,000 out of them, which will fund our budget. I mean, all these things that are buried in an archive. And so I'm reading this. I'm like, this is what Churchill was reading, you know, that day about, so he knew who Popoff was. He knew who my guy was. So for all of these, I just like finding these little nuggets. It's like an Easter egg hunt. You go out and you find a bunch of rocks, but occasionally you find some gold. So that's just part of the enjoyment of me doing the research side of it.
Well, the research, I mean, coming from your background, you know, you said you were a lawyer, and it's all research, you know, and it's you finding specific parts of the law and historical law and everything you can do to bring your case. Yeah, well, it's great.
Actually, and there are a lot of lawyers. Some write fiction, by the way. John Grisham, you know, he used to be a lawyer. But what helped me more than anything was Law Review, because you can go to law school but not really know how to do hardcore, intense research that where literally every line in a law review article has to be footnoted. You have to say where the source came from, and they're going to be checked. I mean, basically in law school, you're talking about cases, but you have to learn how every statement of fact you make has to have a footnote to say where that came from in case a judge or a law professor wants to go check it. And so that's how I was trained. So my books always have huge section of endnotes and bibliographies, because that's what I'm used to doing. And I want people to understand it's not my opinion. If it's in the book, it's verifiable, and you can go to the endnotes and read where it came from. All the dialogue that's in all of my books came right out of primary sources. I don't make up any dialogue, no quotes that I put it in. It's all directly from primary sources.
See, now that's really interesting too, but how challenging did you find it? Because, you know, spies, espionage, I mean, they intentionally obfuscate things. You know, things are omitted intentionally, and then you have the reports with need to know. How frustrating was it to try to figure out where to fill in your holes?
Well, you come in with the assumption that, first of all, everything's classified when these guys are operating, and after they get out, it's still classified. So for all of my books, none of the people could write about what they had done, because they're all under what they signed, oath, that they cannot reveal anything. And then so all of the World War II stuff was classified. And so not until the early 80s that it starts coming, things start becoming unclassified, declassified. And that opens up what I can access, because now I'm either going to the National Archives here at College Park, Maryland National Archives 2, or the UK at Kew, that's where their National Archives are. So that allows me to find out absolutely what really happened. Like in Popoff, he had written a biography, an autobiography, and he had to change every name. He had to change all the names, and he had to change some of the places and change some, because he doesn't want to get in trouble, you know, for what he's writing. Ian Fleming had to do this, even though he was writing fiction. In fact, he got in trouble from MI5. They almost sued him because the Enigma machine he had called Spectra or something like that, and they thought it was too close. You know, he had not been authorized to do that, and they decided not to sue him only because it would have drawn more attention to it. So all these spies have to sign these things, and so not until stuff is declassified do you even find out what happened. But who goes, you know, who says, okay, today let's take a field trip to College Park, Maryland, and just kind of walk through the million files in the archives. No one does that. So you have to have a reason to be there.
Well, with the Watchmaker's Daughter too, if you're talking about a Dutch spy and Dutch spy syndicate, I mean, that must be tough with the language barrier and to try to pull the archives for that.
Well, she wasn't a spy. She was, and this is the first one that I've done that wasn't a spy.
Okay.
She was in the Dutch resistance. So she and her family and their home there, they hid Jews, and they also hid what are called Dutch divers, which are Dutch boys. If you're between like 16 to 35, if the Germans caught you on the street, they would just snatch you and send you off to a German factory, you know, typically never to be heard from again. So they hid both. They hid both of these two groups of people. But she was not a spy. In fact, the only person, the person that actually started them in down this track was a guy by the name of Hans Poli, who was an 18-year-old university student who had to hide because he's 18. He's, you know, they'll snatch him off the street. And he decided he wanted to help the war effort. So he decided to go into the Dutch resistance, which was all underground, of course. And he became a courier, which means he had to dress as a girl. So he had to put on the wig and the dress and all that, get on a bicycle. And so anyway, he was the one that goes back to Corey one day and says, oh, by the way, I joined the Dutch resistance, and I have to take, because this brings more danger to you and everybody in the house, because if I'm caught, being involved with the resistance was a capital crime. They had given him a gun and told him, which, by the way, was also a capital crime to have a gun. And they said, OK, we want you to shadow this Gestapo agent because we're thinking of taking him out, the Dutch resistance. So Hans Poli is shadowing this because either he or somebody else is going to kill him. So so that's what kind of, he told Corey all this, and she's like, well, we want to help. use our home as the headquarters. This will be great. And so that's how the family got pulled into this.
So, you know, when you're talking about putting this information together, so Emma and I both have like the intel background, but then we also have like from the investigative standpoint, it's almost like writing, you know, like a timeline, a chronography, you know, like, hey, how did this work? And then pulling all this information and putting it together, what's your research process like? Are you keeping us like, do you have like a big whiteboard? Do you have a board behind you with sticky notes? How do you keep it intact?
If you saw what I did, and I have to do it this way, I have an Excel spreadsheet and it literally goes day by day by day by day, you know, basically from, I mean, I have to know when the person was born and all that stuff, but in terms of when the action really starts, I have to do every day. And I have to show what happened, where that came from in terms of the source. So I have a very long Excel spreadsheet that tracks that. And so when I'm doing research, if I find something, I have to go, oh, wait, that didn't happen on June 14. It happened on, for example, in Popoff's memoir, he had said that they MI5 had this big party for him on as the bombs are falling on at D-Day on June 6th, which was not the case at all. I got the MI5 files and his case officer said, oh, we had a big party for Popoff on April 16. So that's, I mean, a lot of people might say, well, what's not that much difference of time, but it's a difference. And I have to put what actually happened. So originally I would have had D-Day is when that happened, and then I have to change it. No, I found out a better source, and it happened on April 16th. So I'm constantly going back and forth, changing dates and moving stuff around.
Wow. So yeah, you and Excel are extremely good friends, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, you would cringe if you saw my Excel spreadsheet. You would cringe. It's very small because there's there, but fortunately, Excel does not cut you off on a certain number of lines. So
as soon as you said Excel, I died a little inside. I'm like, oh no.
Yeah. It's pretty scary looking.
But I am curious, like of all the stories that you could tell, like, don't get me wrong, I'm so glad that you chose like, you know, the spies and the, you know, kind of the more unsung heroes from the time period, but there were a plethora of heroes, heroines that you could have chosen. What made you go towards the espionage lilt?
Just in general, because to me that's exciting. I mean, I grew up with James Bond. I mean, Sean Connery was the coolest guy ever, and so for me, Sean Connery was James Bond, and so I was a Bond fan. I like everybody else as a kid, and then you know you're introduced to Ian Fleming's novels and so forth. But I've always just been fascinated. Tell you the truth, I really wanted to be an intelligence officer like you guys and just never graduated to that. So this is my out.
Never say never.
There's still time.
There's still time. You could always be an FSO, Foreign Service Officer or something. They always want people. You know, you talk about sources, and that is so critical when you're providing a nonfiction narrative, and especially when you're providing any type of product. So vetting these sources, I mean, like you said, you can come, one source is going to say this, one source is going to say this, putting them together. Yeah. That's tradecraft. I mean, that's intelligence, you know,
and
summarization.
That's where the general legal training helps too, because lawyers have rules of evidence. You have to take a class, a 5-hour class, a very long class in evidence. And because there's a rule, there are rules and there's a hierarchy on the credibility of evidence. And you have all of these rules and all of these exceptions. So, for example, what is highly credible is a document that was done in the course of everyday routine work that was done at that time, signed at that time, and you know put in the file. That's very credible as opposed to what's not credible, hearsay. There are all these rules on hearsay. So if I pick up a magazine, and there's a quote from somebody, well, that's hearsay. I have to prove, you know, this quote. Or if someone says, well, Bill told John that, I have to prove that. I can't just go on the hearsay. I have to get a direct quote. Like, for example, somewhere in here, in my books, Peter Churchill was Odette Sampson's organizer and boss while they were operating in France. And he wrote three memoirs. So for all of the quotes about him and what he said and what he did, I have to pull from his book, not what a prior biographer said, not what anybody else said. I have to pull it directly from the horse's mouth. And that's just my training as a lawyer dealing with the rules of evidence.
That absolutely makes a lot of sense. And I think it comes through, like when you're doing a story about the watchmaker's daughter, in this case, I saw that you had to not only go with what you had available, but you were pulling from other stories and you actually did the research on, like, everyone else who's tried to tell this story, they only had little facets of it and then things had been admitted. And so I'm assuming that's where your Excel spreadsheet came into play, where you were able to go through, oh, wait, nope, this needs to go here, here, here.
Yep.
But that pays off.
Yeah, that's what I have to do for every book. And on all of my books, there's been a prior biography or autobiography, or in some cases, like Into the Lion's Mouth, there was both. But when I read them, I just knew this is not everything, that this is not all of the information. And again, I knew that I could access classified files now, too, which helped. But for example, with The Watchmaker's Daughter, in 1971, you know, 50 whatever years ago, the Cora Ten Boom did not actually write that book. It was written by two professional writers, John and Elizabeth Sherrills, whose names are on the book. But it only told, when I read it, I kind of figured this, it only told about 10% of the story. It didn't say any, this guy I told you about earlier, Hans Poley, he's not even in the book. And he's the second most important person in the story after Corey. Is this guy named Hans Poley, who got them all involved in the Dutch resistance. He's not even in there. And there's almost nothing on Peter Van Worden, Corey's nephew, who was also involved in the Dutch resistance and wrote his own book. So these guys wrote their own books. That's not in there. And then all of the archives for Corey are in the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College. So I had to go to Wheaton College and spend 4 days there just pouring through every single file, all of her passports, all of her letters, the stuff she wrote in prison, her scraps of paper from prison, when she was in Ravensbrück concentration camp. And it's just file after file, box after box. So it took me 4 days. So all of that, you know, I bring together all that because now I know what really happened. There's always, when you don't, this may sound a little bold, but it's almost like when you don't have a lawyer gathering all this together, you have mistakes because people just assume they don't have rules of evidence to apply to say, I can't count this. That has to come out. I can't trust this. So a lot of times there are things in, for example, in The Princess Spy, there were incidents that I can't, like a murder, that I can't put in because I can't prove that it actually happened. If I can't prove that in fact, the particular murder that I'm speaking of, the Elaine Griffith did make it up. It's completely made up. The guy that was supposed to be the person that was actually the murderer, which she said was her later to be OSS co-agent, he wasn't even in the country for another 6 months. So he couldn't have been the killer. And there was, so, and I checked the newspapers, then she made it up. And so I had to leave it out. And sadly, the families don't know. The families just assume whatever's in the book that their father, grandfather, whoever wrote, that it's all accurate. And that's not the case. Popov made some mistakes. He didn't make anything up, but he made a couple mistakes that I had to correct. But Aileen Griffith, she made some stuff up. And so I had to cut all that out what I could prove, or I had a very good sense of what applying again, another legal standard beyond the shadow of a doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt. There is another murder in there that I think happened. And it was, I know that it happened because I found the sons of her partner in the coding room who were still alive. And they said, hey, Larry, our dad wrote this thing for us, just never published. He wrote a 100-page memoir about what he did during the war because he was a spy. And he was her partner in the coding room. And he says, they said, do you want to read it? And I said, I'd love to read it. Send it to me. It's 100 pages, never published. Well, in there, because I was wondering about another murder that Eileen had said had happened, and it happened in her apartment. And I said, yeah, send this to me. So I start reading this, and lo and behold, I get to the line that says, which reminds me of the night that I removed a dead body from Eileen's apartment. He was the guy they called to remove the body, and he had to wrap it up in a blanket and literally make the body disappear in a foreign country. They're in Spain. They're in Madrid. He has to get rid of this body in the middle of the night. So had I not had that access, I wouldn't have put it in. But I confirmed it by getting this never seen before 100-page memoir by the person who did it. And it's highly credible because he wasn't trying to make money off a book. This was for his family. No one else saw it. No one else has ever seen this thing. And so that was.
You got me even more excited because I'm looking at this like, you know, as someone who's been like in the courtroom and testifying and understanding how the legal process works, to able to get this in there and get the information in there. A vetted book is much more than just a normal historical book where you're just pulling data off of everywhere.
Right.
You know, this is a very vetted book and a very vetted sources. I love it. I'm looking forward to The Watchmaker's Daughter. I think this might be my first one. I'm going to have to backtrack and read the rest of your books, but I'm excited for this. The Watchmaker's Daughter is out now, everybody. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking about all this stuff.
Thanks.
Well, I think everyone's going to need to kind of buckle up for it too, because it's not just history. It is a thriller. I mean, I read just a little portion, you know, talking about 100 babies being rescued from being murdered by the Nazis.
Right.
And if that doesn't make you have an emotional response mm-hmm. to something that actually happened, you might want to check your pulse. So
yeah, there's danger all. I mean, that was life in the Netherlands during that time because they were occupied by the Nazis. And so they had stuff almost every night. There's a German truck that pulls up, a German army truck that pulls up outside their house one night and stays there right in front of their, you know, just feet from their front door. So they all have freak out. They have to scamper up. The refugees have to dive into the hiding place. And the place that they had created only holds a total of 8 people standing up. It's like a small closet. And they have to crawl through a little hole, which they had built in a linen closet. At the very bottom was a trap door. They would all crawl in. And so 4 Jews and 2 resistance agents all had to scamper in there. This was actually on another raid. But raids and threat of raids were happening all the time. So they had a timer. One of the Dutch divers that stayed there was an electrician. So he wired the whole house. He wired the whole house with warning buttons. And so in their watch shop in the bottom, by Corey's desk, by her dad's desk, and by the door, there was a secret button that they could push that would tell the upstairs, you know, the residentials upstairs in the next 2 floors, that would tell them the Gestapo's here, we're having a raid, hide. And so they had practiced how long it would take for everybody to scamper up into the, you know, on the 3rd floor where Corey's room and where this hiding place was. And Corey was timing it. She had them down to 70 seconds for all these people to get through. They had to flip their beds because the Gestapo would touch a bed to see if it was still warm. And so they had to flip all the beds.
Oh, yeah.
And they had to grab whatever stuff was in their room and run with them, whether it's a pipe, anything, and run into this hiding place, which is literally a very small closet. And then once they got in, they would shut the trap door and then wait. And one part of the story, when maybe I shouldn't say, but they're trapped. One part of the story, they're trapped in there and they can't get out because there are German Gestapo agents in the house, and they can't get out. And they've got no food, no water, no facilities, you know, no restrooms. So they had to improvise, and it was not pretty. But that kind of stuff happened all the time in real life. Hans Poli's dad was almost narrowly missed being executed. They were all arrested. They were all interrogated. It was just a daily nightmare for them for 4 years.
You know, we always look at World War II with like this macro level. We look at like the D-Days, we look at Pearl Harbor. Yeah. These are the stories that I like seeing written, is because you want to know what almost like the user level. What's the ground truth? What are the people on the ground actually feeling? What are they going through? Yeah. We know what the troops at D-Day went through, kind of. I mean, we see the books, we've seen the movies, we read the books, we've seen the movies. It's over and over and over again. It's almost like trench warfare. We know trench warfare was bad, but what else was going on in World War I at the time? So having this at that micro level is, it's unbelievable. I love it.
And I drop in because I want people not only to enjoy a story, but also to learn something about history, particularly about World War II. For example, I've put this in all of my books. Most people don't realize the Wehrmacht, the German military, hated the Nazis, hated them. The Nazis were a political party, and Hitler basically armed a group of thugs and gave them uniforms, and they became the SS. Those were not professional soldiers. Those were thugs. And so the professionals, the honorable people like Rommel, for example, who were all like our West Point guys, they were professionals. And there was a code of conduct going back to von Clausewitz and the Prussian history. And so they despised the Nazis. So you have all this friction between the two. In fact, in Codename Lease, they almost went to battle. Where SS guards, SS was Nazi Party too, where the SS guards are holding some German soldiers that fell out of favor with Hitler, as well as a bunch of other people. And one of the colonels that had been arrested stops at a post office when they were there for a break and calls General Kesselring's office and says, get some men over here and save us from the SS. Save us from the SS soldiers. And so you have, and they did. So the 14th Army sends a group, the posse comes, the cavalry comes to rescue this group of people, which was mostly British intelligence agents, officers that had been captured, and some political figures that had been arrested, and then a couple of German officers that had been arrested. And so you have the German army coming in to save Allied people, essentially, from being executed by the SS. And there was going to be a gun battle. And the colonel, in particular, Colonel Bonin was his name, he told the SS guards, oh, by the way, I made a call. The 14th Army is one of their companies is going to be here in 6 hours. So you guys may want to split dodge here, because if they catch you. And so they did. So all of the SS soldiers split and just disappeared because the non-Nazi Germans were coming. So, and most people don't know that. So I have to put in the book somebody put this, highlighted it, I think, in a review with The Watchmaker's Daughter. The Wehrmacht tried countless times to assassinate Hitler or arrest him. And that's why Rommel was executed. Rommel was forced to take poison because he was part of it. All of the top German military tried to get rid of Hitler by execution, by arrest and trial. Rommel wanted to arrest him and try him. And almost no Americans know this. People in Holland know it, but Americans don't know it. So that's, you'll see in my end notes, I have a lot of big footnotes that explain some of that. The general's plot was huge, 38. It's crazy, but everybody knows about the July 2044 putsch where they tried to kill Hitler, which Tom Cruise, was in the movie Valkyrie. Well, those were all Wehrmacht people. Those were all actual German professional soldiers that were all involved, like von Clausewitz or von Stauffenberg. And when the Gestapo found out and started torturing people to give up names, one name led to another, one name led to another. And a lot of the generals already knew, I'm dead. So what happens with that is when the Gestapo is done, 5,000 German officers were either executed or committed suicide, including 12 generals and 3 field marshals, including Rommel. And Americans don't know that. I mean, you don't get that history watching.
Nah.
D-Day or The Longest Yard or Saving Private Ryan. But those were heroes. Those were heroes that gave their lives trying to get rid of Hitler, because they knew, they saw, after a while, they saw, he was a madman. And so 12 generals and 3 field marshals gave their lives to get rid of him. And so I have to, so you'll see there'll be footnotes, you know, throughout about things like that. I can't put it in the main text. It doesn't pertain particularly to the 10 booms, but I give the dates when something happened because I have to follow a calendar. And while one thing's going on at the Baye in their house, well, there might be something going on in Amsterdam. I put in the SOE was dropping agents into the Netherlands. And lo and behold, the agents that they were dropping, the SOE didn't know, Home Office in London didn't know, oh, by the way, Colonel Giskus of the ABWAR basically turned your radio. And so all those people were parachuting into German arms, into German soldier arms. So there's all that stuff that happened that people don't know about. And I have to splice it in. Anne Frank, I have to splice in because
yeah.
It's in Amsterdam. Audrey Hepburn, most people don't know that Audrey Hepburn was in Arnhem. And so she wrote about, saw some of this stuff. So I have to splice in Audrey Hepburn. So I have to put in all of these different things that all happened so that we get a big picture of what that whole time was like there.
Thank you, Microsoft Excel.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Now, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. Everybody, The Watchmaker Daughter is out now. Emma, you have any follow-up questions, anything?
No, I just want to say, I have to applaud you. History is great. We all know it, but it can be dry. So the way you put it together, the way you make it visceral, you can feel it. I mean, it has that thriller edge to it, but it makes it real. Kind of like Jason said, boots on ground. Thank you.
Yeah, I think most people like reading a story. I mean, for example, if you said, well, what's the best single book about World War II? Well, the standard is William Shire's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. But it's dry. I mean, you're reading, you know, it's this thick and you're reading a history book. And so most people don't want to read it. They want a story. And so if you can grab a story and then embellish and put around the edges the history and some of the other things that were happening, it won't spoil the story. And that's a call I have to make with every book is I can't slow the pace down because I want a thriller. I can't slow the pace down by having an info dump here. I've got to put it in either in a footnote or an end note. So that's what I do all the time is if there's good history stuff, it's going in a footnote or it's going in an end note. I'm not putting it in the main text because it'll slow it down.
Bravo, sir. I'm sold. I'm a fan.
Same here, Larry.
There will be a test next week for both of you.
Oh, whoa. Give me two yeah. weeks. Come on.
2 weeks. Okay, we'll give you 2 weeks.
Thank you so much for coming on, Larry.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.